good morning, and welcome to Word of Mouth, the program where captivating people talk about their unique jobs. I'm your host, Jim Wunderlich, and today I'll be chatting with Eric Wentz, author of Killing Sharks, De Profundis. Eric is a 26-year veteran of the U.S. Navy and Navy Reserves. He has served as an intelligence officer, an interrogator, and linguist. His first novel, Piercing the Veil, was published in 2009. His latest book, Killing Sharks, De Profundis, reflects his many experiences as a former UCOM liaison officer to Guantanamo Navy Base and as a former member of the Joint Detention Center and Joint Task Force. And Eric is also a certified scuba diver. Eric, thanks so much for being here.
Well, Jim, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
You know, lots to talk about, and before we discuss your latest book, which we're going to get into, and which I found very captivating, by the way, we're going to talk about the War on Terror, particularly Guantanamo Navy Base. I found that just fascinating. I'd like to back up just a bit, and at what point did you know you wanted to become a Navy intelligence officer, an interrogator? Sort of an interesting job. What triggered your interest there?
Well, first of all, I never knew years ago that I wanted to be an intelligence officer per se. Mm-hmm. I did know, however, that I was probably, if I were going to join any branch of the service, eventually I'd probably end up in the Navy. My father was career Navy. He enlisted in the Marine Corps in World War II. And then after Korea, because of a number of incidents, as he put it, he said, I had a checkered disciplinary career. He said, I decided that I better switch branches of the service before my service record caught up with me. Mm-hmm. He had a history of insubordination.
Oh.
And he liked to fight, even when it wasn't necessary. So anyway, after the Korean War, my father switched to the Navy and spent the rest of his career doing that. And when I was an undergraduate, I did ROTC, and I was headed toward an Army career at that point. However, I graduated in 1972, at which point the Army was looking not to take in prospective officers. And they would tell you things like, okay, we'll take you in, but at 179 days, you'll probably be relieved of whatever position you have, and you'll be sent back home. And the reason for that, they were already winding down in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. They wanted fewer officers, not more. And so eventually I ended up going back toward the Navy, which in many ways is really keeping with my first love. If I can say this of a branch of the service, I actually have a form of affection for the Navy, having grown up on Navy bases in Charleston, South Carolina, the Washington, D.C. area, much of the West Coast. We were up and down the West Coast. There, Camp Pendleton, California, and so forth. So that was all part of it. And today, I have two adult children, both of whom are Army officers. My son just made major, and he married a gal that he met in Iraq, and she's a captain in the Army. Both of her parents are retired Army.
Mm-hmm.
And my son-in-law is Special Forces, and my daughter is also a captain in the Army.
Well, obviously a thread with the military, with your family, and I still want to get back to the jump to being an intelligence officer, an interrogator, because that's a faction or a part of the Navy. How does that occur? What skills do you need? What training do you have? How does that all come about?
I would make the argument that the intelligence officer is probably the person who is most broadly educated. Mm. And by that I mean, take your concept of a liberal arts education. In all likelihood, your intelligence officers will probably come closest to accommodating that in terms of their background. Many of my peers, for example, in the intelligence community have multiple degrees, bachelor's, two or three master's degree, doctorates. Many of them are bilingual. A number of them were not even born in the United States, and that was, in many ways, that was an advantage. They came with language skills from infancy. And what makes it different, again, from the other departments, if you will, mm-hmm. within the Navy, is that typically if you join the Navy, they're going to give you, in fact, all branches do this, they give you an assessment test to determine what your skills are. But if you already come with pre-existing skills, as maybe you're good at construction, maybe you were in construction, they're probably going to siphon you off toward the Seabees, which is the construction mm-hmm. branch of the Navy. Mm-hmm. And maybe you grew up in the backwoods of South Dakota someplace, and you grew up with rifles and guns and so forth. You might be the guy that they looked and said, look at how well he handles the rifles just in basic training. This may be a guy that we want to look at eventually for sniper school.
Mm-hmm.
What you're going to find with the intelligence officer is that he probably has a background in English literature, philosophy, could be theology, mm-hmm. could be an accountant. In other words, he's going to have a number of skills that he's going to bring to the fore. So in that regard, he's a typically liberally arts-educated person.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't have to have those other specific skills. He may have them.
Right, right.
But the paramount skill will be this kind of umbrella concept that would take in history, literature, and so forth. And that's because you're going to be dealing, as an intelligence officer, you're going to be dealing with a wide array of materials gathered from all over the world. And the question is, can you synthesize those into something that makes sense so that the operations side can say, yeah, we have a threat here. How do you know that? Well, we've been listening in on their broadcast, and we notice that they do this typically before they move their military forces from this area of the country to their bordering country. And when they invaded last time, which was 1917, this is what they did as well. They're following an old plan. Well, you won't know that unless you have a background in history. And if you today, for example, it really helps to have a background in theology to understand what jihad means,
mm-hmm.
the multiple definitions of the term. So again, theology, philosophy, the various arts are an aspect of an intelligence officer's background. As a linguist, you may very well be...
Which you are. You have a master's in linguist, right?
In linguistics, rather.
Yeah, right.
And the same thing is true there. If you're going to have a master's degree, typically you have to show proficiency in at least one other language, and you're going to be tested at the graduate level.
Is Arabic the number one now if you're going to be an interrogator?
It really helps a lot.
I would think, yeah.
Arabic, yeah. Pashto, mm-hmm. Most of the dialects spoken in and around Pakistan, mm-hmm. Afghanistan. And the Arabic, oddly enough, is, of course, not the primary one there. We associate Arabic with Al-Qaeda.
Right.
Okay? But the Taliban, most of their members did not speak Arabic. They spoke Pashto, which is a form of, which is one of the dialects of, again, parts of Afghanistan. And as you get closer to the border with Iran, you find that some of them speak Farsi instead, which...
Right, right.
And essentially, they are unintelligible to one another.
Which is interesting,
because mm-hmm.
geographically they're so close.
Yes.
Yeah.
But here again, that was one of the... It remains a problem for the U.S. services to this day, because where you are, even in Afghanistan or elsewhere, you may find that the dialect that you learned or the language you learned is not truly applicable in that many instances.
Mm-hmm.
And we see it even in Iraq, where the native speakers of Arabic... could tell us sometime that a person was lying. And say, how do you know that? Well, the translator might say, well, he tells you that he's from this region. He says, that's southern Iraq. They don't pronounce their words that way. And he might say to you, he's a Kurd. He's from northern Iraq. He's lying.
Mm-hmm. You know, you pick that up a little bit in your book, where sometimes a detainee or prisoner may speak too perfect. In other words, whatever their dialect is, and then it doesn't sound as native. And you can pick up on little things like that.
Well, sometimes it is. They learned it in school. Think of the musical My Fair Lady. You may recall that it's based upon
linguist. We were going with this.
Okay. it's based upon the life of a real linguist who was very reputable.
Right.
And there's that scene in My Fair Lady where she is speaking English so perfectly after her training.
The rain in Spain.
Under Professor Henry Higgins, that the one man says she's a foreigner because English people don't speak English that way. It's too perfect. And sometime, well, here, let me give you another, for instance. Detainees that we had from Morocco, which speak Arabic, have trouble understanding people from Iraq.
Interesting.
You go, it's the same language. But in the same way, you could say that of European languages. You could say that German and English are essentially the same language. At their root, they are.
Mm.
But you and I both know that we're not going to have an intelligent conversation with a speaker of German and a speaker of English unless both of them happen to be linguists and can switch back and forth from one language to the other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I tell you what, though, I'm curious. Does the Navy pick you, or do you pick the occupation? In other words, I'm getting back to the intelligence officer, because I find that just a fascinating job. I mean, okay, so you have all this education, which master's degree in this, and history here, and a doctorate, and you know, you have an incredible resume. So does the Navy say, this guy would be a good intelligence officer, or do you say, this is something I want to hitch into? This is a department I want to be a part of.
It can occur either way. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, the person that comes to the Navy, who may have a contact, maybe a father, a relative of some sort, knows something about the intelligence side. Maybe you've seen a movie, and you realize, hey, I've got a background like that. Why don't I go to this branch of the service? And it doesn't have to be the Navy. It could be the Army. It could be the Marines. Mm-hmm. Say, listen, I'm interested in this. How feasible is that for me?
Mm-hmm.
And typically, they're going to tell you something about where they see you fitting in beforehand. That's part of the recruiting process. And then once you're actually in there, there's a certain fundamental training that everybody has to go through.
And I'm curious, what's like the fundamental, the basic training that you must have? I would think patience would be number one after reading the book. But what would be, I mean, what's something, a real skill set that you have to have?
Well, if you're an analyst, which is typically what an intelligence officer is, you're the person, well, here, let me give you an example of what he does.
Sure.
That. But I'm going to give you an anecdote first.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Probably heard the story of the guy that is trying to hang shelves in his house, and he wants to put up some bookshelves. But he doesn't know where the studs are, and he's afraid that he's going to break through the wall. So he calls the carpenter, and he says, look, he says, I want to put up shelves, but I don't know where to drive the nails. Carpenter does a few things, takes a few measurements, takes out a hammer, takes out a nail, drives the nail. He says, this is where you're going to put all your shelves. You're going to hang them from there. And he says, by the way, that's $50. Guy says, you were here for 2 minutes, $50. He said, that's right. He says, $1 for the nail. And the hammer, $49 for being able to tell you where to put the nail. And in a sense, the intelligence officers, the analysts, are the people that are going to tell, or at least make clear to operations side, where do you send the hammer? Where do you send your troops?
Hmm.
And if you don't know what the enemy's up to, if you don't know what their designs are, and if you're completely unfamiliar with their network of people, you're not going to be able to give them good intelligence such that you can say, this is where we expect the attack to occur, this is where we think they have their concentration of troops. So you just mentioned the word patience. That's an integral part of being an analyst, because you've heard, again, the old proverb about the needle in the haystack. Sometimes that is what you're looking for, and at times the work is tedious because you don't really know, is this the missing piece that I needed? But here again, I'll give you a really good example that I think most people can recognize. You may recall the incident where the Lockerbie of the Pan Am 103 went down over Scotland. It blew up, and it killed about 270 people, a number of them on the ground who were Scots. At first, we didn't know who was responsible. Now, imagine that debris from that aircraft was scattered over several square miles. Our people, including our intelligence officers in different branches and some of the alphabet agencies like the CIA and FBI were involved in that, as were people in the British Isles. After several months, they found a detonator. Mm-hmm. One little thing about as big as my thumb.
Hmm. There's the needle.
Guy said, this is made by an American construction company. And then they said, okay, who do they sell to? And eventually they said, this detonator was sold by this company in America to a construction outfit in Libya. Next connection. And eventually they've pinned it down to the Libyans. And you may recall again the Fury just a couple of years ago, when the person who was eventually convicted for blowing up the airline.
Yeah, they finally got him.
The Scots released him on humanitarian grounds, and he went back to Libya, where he got a hero's welcome, by the way. That wasn't the end of the story. Our intelligence officers and others were able to trace other bits and pieces, and eventually we found out, they were the ones that detonated the plane with Muammar Gaddafi's consent. But the people behind it were the Iranians, who paid the Libyans $10 million for the detonation.
Unbelievable.
And you say, well, what would cause them to do that? Well, about 6 months earlier, we had blown up a passenger plane flying over the Persian Gulf over one of our aircraft carriers. And the protocol for American aircraft carriers, nobody gets within 100 miles. After all, you got 6,000 men, as many as 6,000 on a ship. You don't want the enemy getting too close. And among other things, we gave them repeated warnings, and they would not answer. And at the very least, they should have answered. When they get too close, the standard operating procedure for the American Navy is you launch. You don't take a chance that that's someone headed toward you in a suicide mission or something like that. So we blew up the plane. Okay? Many people think that the Lockerbie incident was retribution for our having shot down their passenger plane.
That's been one theory. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is fascinating, though. So it is really looking for that needle in the haystack often.
Well, if you take a more contemporary example, then just think about how they finally tracked down bin Laden. That was one piece of evidence that came out of Guantanamo, and one piece of evidence only. And it had to do with a courier. And somebody at Guantanamo had to do the questioning of the interrogator, of the detainee, to know enough to ask this specific question. And despite, again, what movies show.
Yeah, Zero Dark Thirty is what I'm thinking of right now.
Right, right. Well, Zero Dark Thirty alludes to it.
But it doesn't really mention it like you are right now.
Right, right. But
so say that one more time, because this is, for me, this is new information.
In 2007, a piece of information came out of Guantanamo, and the piece of information had to do with a courier.
Okay.
Okay, now what I'm telling you...
A courier to bin Laden.
Bin Laden.
Okay.
It was one of those things that eventually... Somebody is able to put this together and say, if we can find the courier, we can do this. Mm-hmm. Then we can start piecing together where it is most likely that bin Laden is. That's what really led to bin Laden's eventually being pointed to, such that we could say, we're going to send our forces in now. We think he's here. That was, or at least that began the investigation. Subsequently, then we got someone else involved who could ascertain that, yeah, there's this compound there, and we now have DNA evidence indicating that family members are there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably where he is. But again, that was a piece of evidence that came out of the questioning, the interrogations at Guantanamo.
One thing Hollywood did do, we're getting kind of off track a little bit, I guess, but it did a, I think, a fairly adequate job, and you can tell me yes or no to this, of showing the behind the scenes. Not necessarily, you know, what the Navy SEALs, because that's what everybody wants to see, a Navy SEAL going in there and kicking some butt. But the behind the scenes and the tediousness, as you just talked about, and some of the dull-to-dull day-to-day routine things you have to do to be able to get that information.
Well, I think that they did show that, and you saw the one girl in particular who was expressing her frustration repeatedly.
Right.
Like, why don't we move on this?
Mm-hmm.
We've got the evidence. And part of that is politics. I would suggest to you that... You and by and large, you want an intelligence community which is free from the local political influence.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want them to be influenced by the Democrats or the Republicans or the Libertarians. You want them to be a separate agency that has its own integrity intact. And I think that part of that was, and I don't want to go too heavily into this, but there were concerns that were partially political. And you better make sure that you're right and blah, blah, blah. But there's more to it than that, too.
Well, ever since Jimmy Carter, sorry to interrupt, ever since that gaffe, that's been, I think, they're making sure it is foolproof before they go in, or nearly so, 99.9%. I'm sorry, go ahead. You're going to say something.
Yeah, but nonetheless, I think they did do an adequate job of showing that. There is that frustration, and there's that day-to-day, and sometimes you're not quite sure, is this the guy? And think about the guy that sits behind and listens to messages over the radio, and he says, is that really, or Al Jazeera, is that tape really coming from bin Laden, or is it someone who sounds like bin Laden? And in other words, the guy that has to do the voice analysis. And it's exciting, perhaps, when you get that piece. But in the meantime, you may be waiting for that piece.
Yeah.
You're doing other things. But the other thing is, and let me give you another example from history. You know, one of the, what is considered one of the critical battles of World War II, at least for the Pacific theater, is the Battle of Midway. You know, the Battle of Midway probably wouldn't have turned out the way that it did, except for the fact that several months earlier, the Americans had picked up a radio broadcast, where they or a radio transmission from a Japanese pilot who made mention to something that he was flying over. And it wasn't anything that anybody recognized. It wasn't a recognizable name. But somebody jotted it down.
Mm-hmm.
Several months later, when the Japanese are preparing to attack Midway, the name popped up again. So the guy concluded, okay, when that Japanese pilot was flying, where was he flying? He was flying near Midway. We think that is the Japanese code word for Midway. Therefore, we think the Japanese are now prepared to attack Midway. Again, one analyst picking up a piece of information, retaining knowledge of that so that months later he can apply it in a situation that is absolutely critical. And, of course, that's the turning point of the Pacific Theater War.
Fascinating. One little piece like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just fascinating. Boy, we haven't even got to your book yet. We haven't even got to Guantanamo yet.
Yeah.
No, but this is all great stuff, Eric. It's enlightening. And I think your book triggers a lot of these kinds of questions. I do want to ask you quickly, though, I don't know if you can give me a short answer to this or not. Probably there isn't one. But how did you wind up being an interrogator in Guantanamo? How did that happen?
There was a specific request made.
Okay.
And it had to do with certain skills that I had. And in light of that...
And is that dialects? Is that the skills?
Well, I
at least your main character, there's a lot, or one of the characters seems to be pretty good at dialects.
I can't get into specifics of that. But
by the way, this may come up again, Eric, where I might push you a little bit. Okay, so you had certain skills. Now I feel like I'm talking to Liam Neeson. Okay, but you did. You had certain skills, and that's right. Why you went to Guantanamo.
Right.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about Guantanamo. And, biking with a friend yesterday, I said, you know, maybe I need a little history lesson, he had said to me. Mm-hmm. And could you give me or give our listeners a brief history lesson of Guantanamo? And I think what I've always found interesting is how did a U.S. Navy base end up in a communist country, Cuba? And I just find that, where's chicken and egg? How did that all come about?
Well, first of all, the United States has been there for over 100 years already.
Right.
We were there right after the Spanish-American War. In fact, we were there
So it goes back to Teddy Roosevelt then.
Right. We were there during the Spanish-American War.
Right.
Guantanamo is not that far from San Juan Hill
right.
and the other areas where the Americans landed in that campaign. And we recognized even before we went in that this is a wonderful harbor. After all, the Spanish had used it. Columbus
landed there. Exactly.
In his second voyage.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to that, the British had used it as a base. It really is a wonderful facility in many ways. It's an enclosed facility, and it really offers refuge to ships in that part of the world.
You know, real quick about the setting. How big is that harbor, and is the Navy base encompassed the whole harbor or just a piece of it?
The harbor that we encompass actually is of such a nature that, first of all, there's about a 17-mile fence line.
That's what it is. Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
And the fence line actually crosses over the water. Okay? And there are bridges that our Marines actually go on with their patrols and so forth. But beyond that fence, those bridges, there's more harbor. And there's another city. These are Cuban cities. The ships going to the communist Cuban side have to go through Guantanamo.
Hmm.
And they have to get permission from the United States to enter U.S. waters. Now, again, for those people that say, yeah, but it's a communist state. However, the treaty agreement, which goes all the way back to about 1904, is such that no one side can negate the treaty. Both sides have to agree. So obviously, if Cuba says, we want you out, we're going to say, okay, nice, but we're not leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes back to the original agreement. And when Fidel Castro took over, Fidel Castro took payment from the United States. As far as we were concerned, that was another reaffirmation of the agreement. And at one point, we were paying them in gold. Now we pay him in checks that he doesn't cash. Okay? And he's saying, well, in effect, I don't recognize this. But we say, yeah, but you took the gold. And you took the original amount that we had offered.
So, what was that original amount?
Oh, I forget the exact amount, but it was nominal. And it was really there as much as anything, I suppose, to simply say, okay, this is a goodwill gesture on our part to indicate the fact that we still think it belongs to Cuba, but we're renting it indefinitely.
So it's like we're renting or leasing Guantanamo.
Right, right.
Interesting. Okay. All right, so that's kind of a quick history lesson. That's why we're in a communist country. Goes all the way back to Teddy Roosevelt.
And in 1963, 64, when the Cubans tried to push us out, that's when they had the Russian forces there en masse. Mm-hmm. And at one point during the Cuban Missile Crisis, they had their tanks positioned all around Guantanamo. And that was to make ready for an invasion. However, we didn't back down. And as you know, we had the quarantine of Guantanamo, and our ships were all around. And so we were making it clear, we're not going to tolerate this. So even when he did push, I think he recognized the United States was prepared to push back in a very hard manner. And we had a lot of Marines there stationed at the time, a lot more than we have today. And we were actually prepared for an assault. If you ever go there, too, you'll see that all the roads leading from communist Cuba have tank traps. And the whole idea was that if the tanks enter this area, they're not going to be able to make it through. And we used to, until the Clinton administration, all the area between Cuba proper and Guantanamo, that whole area was mined. So that if you did send infantry
across, off the road?
Yeah, off the road.
So the road to, say, Havana or whatever, there's not a problem there. But if you just go off the road just a bit.
Well, the roads that enter Guantanamo from the Cuban side, okay, they have tank traps. But then if you tried to send infantry across the desert and the southwestern looking like landscape there with the bushes and the cactus and everything, there are mines all through that area, or there used to be. Then during the Clinton administration, Clinton wanted the area demined. And so the mines, for the most part, were taken out of there. And to my knowledge, there were three or four that they could not find, and that's because the earth moves.
Mm.
And so we had templates or blueprints, if you will, where the mines had all been positioned, but there were several that were not found.
How many troops are down there now? You say that it's diminished. So what do we have down there now?
Right now you have about 7,000 altogether, and that includes the people that work, as they say, behind the wire. Behind the wire, if someone asks you what you do at Guantanamo and you don't want to be real specific, you'll say, I work behind the wire. That means I work in the prison camp down there.
And the detention camps then were built in 2002? After 9/11?
Right. There was already a facility there, which typically is what you see on the evening news. The evening news has stock footage.
Right.
And unless you've been to Guantanamo, you don't know oftentimes that they're not really using pictures of Guantanamo's prison camp today. They're using pictures of what is known as Camp X-Ray. Camp X-Ray is the facility built to house the Haitian refugees and others.
Right.
And that's open bay area. And so especially if you want to make the United States look bad, you show pictures of Camp X-Ray. Because, again, these are not your long-term facilities. They were built there to house the fact that we had this influx of refugees, many of them Haitians, and we also had many Cubans crossing over trying to get to Guantanamo to get out of communist Cuba.
I tell you, we have not even gotten to your book yet. There's so much to talk about, and we will be back with Eric Wentz after these messages. And that is Survivor, Eye of the Tiger, theme from Rocky. And you're listening to Word of Mouth. My name is Jim Wunderlich, and my guest today is Eric Wentz. U.S. Navy, Navy Reserve, 26 years, and was an interrogator and intelligence officer in Guantanamo. And if you're just joining us, we've got quite a lesson, or I should say history lesson, on Guantanamo. And Eric's also an author. We have not talked about your book yet. And it's interesting when you get into the book, and the book is called Killing Sharks, De Profundis, and talks a little bit about the war on terror and what it takes to be an intelligence officer, a lot of behind the scenes with scuba diving. Tell you what is the storyline in a couple sentences? Why don't you give our listeners a storyline?
Okay, the briefest version I can give you is this. This is the story of an Al-Qaeda orchestrated attack on Guantanamo, intending to release some of the detainees there, but ultimately to embarrass the United States.
Okay.
And the protagonist in the story is Lieutenant Commander Grant Chisholm, U.S. Navy SEAL.
I love that name, Grant Chisholm.
It's very Scottish, okay? And his ancestors, if you read the first book, are from Scotland.
Oh, okay. All right.
So, and the book, well, let me give you just a heads up on this aspect of it as well. The book, Killing Sharks, De Profundis. Originally, the title of the book was De Profundis, but then one publisher said to me, no one will buy a book with a Latin title. I said, well, my alternate title was Killing Sharks. I said, but I still want the De Profundis in there. Now, the Killing Sharks has something to do, believe it or not, with Islamic jihadists.
Hmm.
And I'm not going to give away that aspect of the story. But De Profundis has multiple meanings. First of all, it literally means out of the depths. And since much of the story takes place underwater.
Exactly.
I thought that was appropriate. But the other reason for it is that this is emblematic of what Samuel Huntington in his Clash of Civilizations might very well say, this is the conflict between the Islamic world and the West. Well, in the Middle Ages, when the Spanish were attempting to take back the Iberian Peninsula from the Muslims, there was a group of knights called the Knights of Santiago, or St. James, and their battle cry was De Profundis, which comes from one of the Psalms, De Profundis, out of the depths of my soul I cry to you, O Lord. And they would shout that out before going into battle. If I die, O Lord, in effect, take care of me, because I cry out to you from the depths of my soul. So I thought, inasmuch as we're dealing with this conflict between the jihadist and the West, I thought it had multiple meanings, all of which were applicable to this story.
Why did you write the book?
I had several reasons for doing it. First of all, as anyone, I think all of us like a good story. And I had read enough stories over the years by Tom Clancy's and Vince Flynn and so forth. I thought, first of all, I can do this. The difficulty was, while I was in the service, I couldn't do it. I didn't have the time. And at times, I didn't even have the inclination. I was just too absorbed in other activities. The other thing is, I wanted to show a side of the military, particularly as it applies to this war on Guantanamo, because I think that one of the disservices that our own nation has engaged in is at times a plethora of attacks on our soldiers who oftentimes don't get to defend themselves in a public venue.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the novel was an opportunity to do that, and especially with Guantanamo. Some of the attacks upon the people at Guantanamo are so egregious and outrageous, I thought, why don't we talk back? Well, we weren't allowed. Well, now that I'm retired, I'm allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in effect, I'm saying, you don't know how difficult the situation down there is. And I would say that some of the time, it's the news media with its own bias. And also, I would say that some of the attorneys who represent a number of the detainees have, at times, engaged in a kind of disinformation regarding what's going on down there. Let me give you an example, because the questions typically asked of me is, oh, you're at Guantanamo, did you waterboard anybody? And the answer, first of all, is no, okay? But secondly, the idea that all this torture in at Guantanamo is occurring is in part the result of inferences that the public draws from misleading news articles. Here's an example. A couple of years ago, I read an article about Guantanamo written by a certain newspaper, all of which we'd recognize immediately by name, so I won't mention it.
I will. New York Times.
Okay. Well, it was...
Well, they're the one. Let's face it.
It was something like this. It said, and detainee so-and-so, and then they gave his number.
Is this in reference to the Australian?
No. No.
Someone, you know who I'm referring to?
Yeah,
there,
I do.
Too.
I do.
Okay, all right.
Detainee
all right.
So-and-so, such-and-such a number, who was waterboarded, comma, is currently in his third year at Guantanamo, or fourth year. Anybody reading that would probably infer that the waterboarding took place at Guantanamo. And I think that's what they want you, oftentimes, to infer.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, unless I'm mistaken, it didn't occur there. CIA has admitted they waterboarded people, but they did that at sites other than Guantanamo. In other words, what they call the black sites. Okay?
The black sites. Let's take that a little. Do you mind?
Well, those are the sites of the CIA. They won't specify where they are. They're just saying, yeah, we picked these guys up and we waterboarded them to get information quickly, and it worked.
Okay.
And
But not in Guantanamo.
Not in Guantanamo.
Hmm.
Then after they were through, then they sent them to Guantanamo. But the public that reads that so-and-so who's at Guantanamo was waterboarded supposes that that was taking place at Guantanamo. The fact that it wasn't taking place there simply isn't explained in many of the news articles. And again, I don't want to get into too many specifics here because I'm not out to embarrass anybody, but when it comes to...
Well, it's good to hear both sides because you have, at least the side I've heard is Amnesty International and the American Red Cross, who goes in there as well. So you do get, you know, it's good to look at a vertical perspective and get both sides.
Well, it's interesting how little attention the International Red Cross gets. International Red Cross said this is one of the best-run prisons in the world and should serve as a model for the rest of the world. You haven't heard that, though, have you?
No, I tell you what your book did illuminate, though. And there's, for the listeners, it was interesting because, you know, what you do get is the one side, like you're saying, and it's good to get the other side. And I think some people have to evaluate both sides and see where they come. You know, there's the old saying, somewhere in the middle is the truth kind of a thing. But there is, when you talk about the how the guards would come to attend to the prisoners, and this is fairly early in the book, and I, you know, it was just kind of jarring when I heard, you know, they would throw their feces right in the face of the guards. And the guards, instead of retaliating, at least in the book that you wrote, what you were getting was this incredible patience, professionalism. They might ask for a bottle of water, then they would pour the water right. I'm talking about the prisoners now, the detainee would pour the water right on the floor, right in front of the guard. And then the guard patiently would go and get another bottle of water. And at some point, you want to say, well, Jesus, enough is enough. So you are getting conflicting opinions. You're getting the New York Times, the American Red Cross, Amnesty International. And then you do get your book, which is a novel, but from what I can tell, and I won't put words in your mouth, there's a fine line between fact and fiction. So you do get that other side of it. And I guess the question that I would like to ask, though, or where I'm coming, or I'd like you to explain, what was the relationship between the guards and the prisoners, or between the interrogators and the prisoners, or detainees, as we refer to them? What was that like? Was it like what's in the book? I mean, very, very professional. I mean, for the most part, the portrayal you have in the book is incredibly positive, which obviously is much different than the newspaper we were just talking about, and I'll mention them, New York Times. So, you know, what was it like?
Well, first of all, a number of the interrogators that you have down there are really well-educated people. And, I mean, we have people that are involved in this that have doctorates, again, in various fields of endeavor and not just language skills. You may have an interrogator who doesn't actually have the language-specific skill needed to interrogate a given individual. And so he will conduct what they call the interviews with a detainee with a translator right there. Okay. And one of them may have a military background. The translator may not have a military background, but maybe that person was born in Egypt and therefore knows dialect better than everybody else and can pick up subtleties and nuances that would suggest this person's not telling the truth, because I can tell from the dialect alone he's not really from Egypt. He's probably from Libya or Algeria. Mm-hmm. And one of the difficulties we had at Guantanamo from the very beginning and elsewhere is that they use so many different names. We had one detainee, I recall, eventually we were able to track him down by 17 different names. In other words, this guy who said this, and we picked it up on a radio broadcaster transmission in Afghanistan, that's the same guy that we have at Guantanamo who's here and blah, blah, blah. And eventually you go, oh, he's got 17 different names. And eventually you would tie those names into him. And it takes a long time to do that. And the other thing, and I want to go back to this, that sometime the denigration of the efforts of the U.S. forces. Let me suggest to you how, in some ways, that is compounded by what the media has presented here in the United States. I would simply say this. Remember that the law firms that represents a number of the detainees mm-hmm. at Guantanamo is the same law firm that represents the victims of 9/11. Personally, I consider that a violation. It's, at the very least, I think of it as a kind of... you're working at cross purposes with yourself. And it seems to me you can't represent both sides, and yet they do. And I think, by and large, the American public doesn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen the presentations by that law firm, and I would suggest to you that they are jaundiced and not entirely accurate.
Hmm. Yeah, an attorney might say something different in regard to that.
He might.
Yeah.
But I've talked to some other attorneys about it. They said, yeah, I said, we would never take both sides of the same issue in our law firm, one side or the other, because then you have a conflict of interest.
Yeah, I see that. Back to the, and I guess the original statement was, what was the general rapport between the interrogators and the detainees? Because I'm trying to wade through your book, which has the one side, the New York Times, which has the other side. I'm just trying to find where are we at.
Generally
here?
Speaking, you're going to find that...
And maybe rapport is the wrong word. I don't know.
Well, at times you do develop a rapport.
Mm-hmm.
And you want information. And again, despite movies, most information is garnered through patience. And you have to build a rapport. And that might mean eating with the detainee. You're having dinner with the detainee inside the prison camp.
Hmm.
And in a sense, I remember as one detainee told me as we finished dinner, he said, you're always welcome in my home. And from his perspective, I was in his cell, and therefore it's his home, and he was breaking the fast of Ramadan.
Hmm.
And so if I wanted to talk to him, the way it works at Guantanamo, you would wait until evening so that he could have his prayers and so forth and be respectful of Ramadan.
Mm-hmm.
But he would invite me. He wanted me to come to dinner with him. And so I would bring the meal, which was fixed in such a way that would be appropriate for Ramadan. And the rapport that I had with certain people was, what I would say, was very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is going to sound strange to some people, but I think that there were detainees that liked me, and there were some that I liked. And I thought, in another day, another time, another world, we might actually have been friends.
Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't surprise me. You're spending so much time with this person.
Right.
And getting to know this person.
And that's why some of them will eventually divulge information. Now, here's the thing. Again, this is why I say the movies are misleading in this regard. They have the good cop, bad cop. It's become a cliche of interrogation
scenes. Right.
But oftentimes what happens is the person that likes you still doesn't like to be confronted with, give me this piece of information. But if he likes you, he might just inadvertently divulge something that he knows you're probably going to take note of. It doesn't mean you write it down at that moment, but just think, he just gave me a piece of information that I've been looking for a year, and he knew it, or he had a phone number.
Can you give an example, or is that classified?
Let me think about that, because I don't want to get into such a specific endeavor that or piece of information that you'd pin it down to a specific detainee.
Right. And then that gets to be problematic.
Yeah,
right.
But so there were those incidents. Now, there are other guys that never talked. They simply refused to talk. There are others that would not talk to female interrogators.
Right. That comes clear.
It's very clear.
And loud in your book, right?
And some of them said, they said, you insult me.
They felt humiliated.
They felt. And the other thing is, and this is a cultural difference. In the Arab world, to send a young interrogator in who's in his 20s is an insult.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
They preferred an older guy. That's why I would go in sometime, because I'm older. And I remember one interrogation scene in which there was a female interrogator, and very attractive. Now, you would think, most guys would say, wow, I want her to interrogate me. Well, what would happen is the detainee would turn away.
Mm-hmm.
What she would do is ask the question. He would then turn to me and answer the question, but he wouldn't look at her. And many of the women would cover themselves almost completely, so that no skin was showing.
Mm-hmm.
Again, trying to be respectful of the cultural differences. But you would see things like that. And there are other instances in which the interrogator would find himself being requested specifically by a detainee. In other words, I like that interrogator. I'll talk to him, but I won't talk to anybody else, because a rapport had been established. And I can't get into a whole lot of specifics, but I will say this. Mm-hmm. In 2008, there was an instance in which, actually it was 2007, fall of 2007, there was an instance in which the United States, Pakistani forces were converging upon an area near Tora Bora, where the defense was so rigorous by Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, we thought that there has to be a high-value person there, such as bin Laden. Okay? And that information that led to our going to that specific place looking for bin Laden was the result of a change in interrogators. One interrogator had not been able to develop a rapport over a period of about a year with a specific detainee. But somebody noticed that that detainee had a particular affection for his mother.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said, you need an older female interrogator. Within several weeks, she had more information than anybody else had been able to get out in several years. And you go, what's the difference? The rapport. For whatever reason, he liked that type of person, was much more willing and open with her than he had been with anybody else.
Now, that other interrogator had a whole year to develop the rapport. So was that just strictly because of the gender in this case?
It could have been.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of time, they won't tell you what it is. They just won't talk.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you can sit there in silence, say a few words, and then leave because mm-hmm. you recognize the fact that this is futile. We've met before. We've met 10 other times, and you haven't said anything. And then sometime...
Is that the most... Oh, go ahead.
I think at times that's the most difficult.
You knew what I was going to ask. Yeah. Is that the most difficult thing about being an interrogator?
Well, I think that because it's so frustrating. Because you have things to ask, and you recognize the fact they're not going to talk. Now, let me add something else here, because this is one reason that, by and large, the military was opposed to sending the lawyers in. We were getting a lot more information before the lawyers came in.
When did the lawyers come in?
I think it's about 2005 they started coming in.
So 3 years after the detention camp was built.
And what happened is that, one, the suicides started.
That's right.
Two.
Right.
We also had instances of the detainees who had been cooperating stopped cooperating. In other words, they wouldn't talk any longer.
Hmm.
And I'm sure that the advice was coming from their attorneys that, you don't cooperate, you don't talk, you don't say anything. And so the cooperation stopped. And in a conventional war, the attorneys wouldn't have been there in the first place. But in this circumstance, which is so dramatically different, we have a situation that eventually the Supreme Court ruled, and there are several Supreme Court decisions, but one of the more famous also is what's known as the Boumediene decision. And Boumediene is a detainee who was at Guantanamo.
Oh, I thought they didn't have names. I thought they just had numbers.
Well, his name was on the court documents, and it's been released to the public.
Okay.
And he was an Algerian that we picked up in the Balkans.
And, interesting.
Yeah, it is, because some of the people that we picked up, we knew about them before 9/11. They were involved in the war in the Balkans and the conflict between the Muslims, the Christians, the Croats, the Serbs, and so forth. But let me give you one more example here, just to show you how difficult things can be at times and how difficult it is for the guards, among others. You can develop any kind of rapport that you want. At a certain point, I still remember what one person said. He said, don't mistake the friendship that you're developing now and to think that he wouldn't slit your throat if he had the chance.
Hmm.
There's a side of me that recognizes that that was part of it, too. In other words, they were a captive audience. I guess you could say they might as well have said to themselves, well, I might as well be pleasant because I have nothing to gain mm-hmm. by doing anything other than this. There were a number of detainees that were released over the objections of the military, and roughly 20 to 28% have now gone back to what we call jihadist activities. They've simply disappeared.
I saw that statistic. That's crazy.
Well, here's an even crazier story. We picked up a particular guy in Afghanistan after a firefight, and because of certain injuries that he had sustained in a previous firefight, his leg was amputated, not by us, but by Al-Qaeda physicians.
Mm-hmm.
When we picked him up, the leg was badly damaged, and part of the bone was actually protruding from the leg where they had cut it off. And when he got to Guantanamo, they did surgery. They fixed the leg as well as they could, and eventually they fitted him for a prosthetic leg. Several years later, he was released, and part of his argument was, well, what can I do? Look at me.
Mm.
Okay? We released him. And I think it was 17 or 18 months later, maybe a little bit longer than that, there was another firefight in Afghanistan, and we killed a number of the Afghans shooting at our troops. We found a guy with a prosthetic leg.
Hmm.
It was the same guy. How do we know? We checked the prosthetic leg. The prosthetic leg was the one for which we had fitted him at Guantanamo. So a lot of these guys come back to haunt you, and we released several people because the Russians wanted them. And a lot of people don't know that some of the detainees down there were Russians. And southern Russia has a lot of Muslims, and they were part of the group that had gone into Afghanistan. Not long after we released them, there was an attack in southern Russia, which didn't get a whole lot of play in the United States. In about one day, 130 people were killed by, and the event seems to have been orchestrated by several detainees from Guantanamo that we released. And they attacked a police station in southern Russia and killed a number of people. Most of them were killed as well, that is, the former detainees. There are enough instances of this. And other people say, well, you know, if you just give the governments in Saudi Arabia and Yemen and so forth an opportunity to rehabilitate them, it'll all work out. Well, in Yemen, for example, we released some of them to the Yemeni government, and they all managed to escape at one point.
Mm.
And then the Saudis, after a couple of years, could not account for them. They didn't know where they were. They had simply disappeared. And that was part of their rehabilitation program. And throughout all of this, and you, going back to your original question, why did I write this book? I've read the literature written by some of the former detainees at Guantanamo. And some of the stuff is an outright lie.
Mm.
But when they were printing it, we couldn't say anything. And I don't even have to address the specifics of what were the outright lies, other than at a certain point, some of them were so egregious and so over the top, you go, that couldn't have happened, because if it had, he'd be dead. But nonetheless, if you have a gullible public that doesn't hear a different side, they may very well believe all of this stuff. And so, again, that's part of the reason I wrote the book, because mm-hmm. I saw firsthand what was happening, and oftentimes it conflicted with what the newspaper accounts were, with what an Amnesty International might have said, or others.
And, the Red Cross and others, yeah.
And some of the time again, I go back to the sometime glowing reports simply got buried. You go, why didn't they print that one that the Red Cross said, this is such a well-run prison?
I think we have time for one more comment or question, and you may have already answered this, but Guantanamo, open, closed? I mean, it appeared that the Obama administration was leaning towards closing it. And then they were going to move the detainees to Thompson, Illinois, in a prison here, which was interesting. I remember that very much. And then in January of 2011, Obama signed the Defense Authorization Bill that placed restrictions on transferring prisoners to the mainland, which is kind of an about-face. Because originally, we're going to close it down. Prisoners were going to come to Illinois. Now we have, 144 that are still there? There's a few that are still there, okay? Where are we at? And we just have time, just a minute or so here. And I'm sorry for the long question and the brief answer, but what do you think? Close it down, keep it up? It would seem to me you're leaning to keeping it
going. I keep it open.
Yeah.
First of all,
because of the 20% figure.
It's not just that. You also have to consider the protection of your translators, many of whom are not native-born Americans who have families in Egypt, Libya, Iraq, and so forth. You have to protect them. Right now, they have a certain degree of anonymity.
Mm.
You bring them to Thompson, Illinois, or elsewhere. Generally speaking, I think it's going to be a lot easier to find out who they are. The next thing you know, you send that information back to people in Iraq or elsewhere, and they find their family members being assassinated because of information that we are divulging. Right now, that's not happening, but it could happen if they have to bring them to the United States. The other thing is, generally speaking, Guantanamo is a secure facility. It's hard to get there. And therefore, those people do feel a certain comfort, and they know that, by and large, they are protected by the United States military.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get the cooperation because they feel secure.
Eric Wentz, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Again, Jim, thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the book and other things as well.
And I tell you what, if you want to learn more about the book and about Eric, and let's plug the book one more time. It's called Killing Sharks, De Profundis, and gives you another perspective, as you heard in this last hour on Word of Mouth. You can go to Eric's website, ericwentz.com, and that has all kinds of information for you. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope you'll drop by again next Thursday at 11 o'clock a.m. when we talk to another captivating guest on Word of Mouth.